The Columbia Workshop presents, from the studios of the British Broadcasting Corporation in London, Death of a Queen, adapted for radio and produced by Val Gielgud, from Hilaire Belloc, Marie Antoinette. Mr. Gielgud has for the past 10 years been director of dramatic and special feature programs for the British Broadcasting Corporation, and is one of the outstanding pioneers in the development of radio drama. As producer and author of several of the most successful radio dramas presented in Britain, Mr. Gielgud has been invited by the workshop to present this unusual radio piece. Employing a dramatic technique new to American broadcasting, Mr. Gielgud, by use of contrasting vocal qualities and varying tempos, tells the tragic story of the last days of Marie Antoinette, Queen of France. The Columbia Workshop offers with pride Mr. Val Gielgud's production, Death of a Queen.
On August the 10th, 1793, the Federal volunteers from Marseille led the Paris revolutionaries to the storm of the Tuileries Palace and the massacre of Louis XVI's Swiss Guard.
In that 1 hour of combat, there had perished many thousands of men and the tradition of 900 years. The fall of the palace ended the French monarchy. Louis XVI was tried, condemned, and killed. The queen was imprisoned, and her child, the Dauphin, taken from her. The kings of Europe made alliance against revolution, and their armies moved westwards against France. Cried Danton,
"The king's business with our armies. We hurl at their feet in defense the head of a king."
There are two avenues of approach westward into the heart of France. They pass, the one between the Vosges and the Ardennes, the other between the Ardennes and the sea. The first, the passage of Lorraine, was still blocked by the defense of Mayence and the lines of Wissembourg. The second, the passage by the Low Countries, was all but won.
Of the fortresses defending that passage, Maubeuge would soon be the very last to stand.
The line of defense, stretched like a chain across that long, flat frontier, was breaking down. Point after point upon the line had gone. It held now by one point remaining, and the ruin of that was imminent.
When that march began, there would be nothing for those who had challenged the world but to cover their faces and to die.
Maubeuge was the pivot of that door.
The fortress of Condé fell.
No provisions entered Maubeuge.
On July the 26th, Hubé, representative on mission for Parliament, sent to Maubeuge, heard an unusual problem. On the 30th, he wrote,
"We hear no firing from Valenciennes, but we are confident they cannot have surrendered."
They had surrendered.
The officer in command of Maubeuge awaited his orders. They came from Paris in 2 days.
"Valenciennes has fallen. You answer on your head for Maubeuge."
Far off in Germany, the French in Mayence had surrendered.
So July ended, and immediately upon the 1st of August, the defiant decree was thrown at Europe that the queen herself should be tried. At 2:30 on the morning of the 2nd, the order reached her.
She showed no movement of the body or the mind. She dressed herself and made a little package of clothes. She embraced her daughter gently and bade her regard Madame Elizabeth as her second mother. She turned to go and did not look backward. But as she went out, she struck her head violently against the lintel of the door. They asked her if she was hurt, and she answered in the first and only words that she addressed to her captors, that nothing more on earth could give her pain.
As the queen drove through the night, silent as it was, there reached her those noises of a city that never ceased.
These noises were the more alive in this horrid August dark of 93, because the last agony was now risen high upon the revolution. The news had been of defeat, of cities fallen, of Valenciennes itself surrendered, so that the next news might be the last. In Maubeuge, all the meat, salted and fresh, was sequestrated. The manuscripts in the monastery were torn up for cartridges. On the 6th of October, all hay and straw were commandeered.
Upon the 12th, the council was taken of the desperate need to advise the government that the place was almost gone. And it was designed that by night, such as my volunteer should bear the news or perish in crossing the line.
That evening of the 12th, after dark, Marie-Antoinette was led out from her cell for that preliminary interrogation, which in French procedure precedes the public trial.
They led her from her little cell through the narrow passages into a great empty hall. Two candles, the only light in that echoing darkness, stood upon the table. Her dress was dark and poor.
She sat between two policemen upon a bench in the vast black void of the unfurnished hall and answered. And when she had answered, signed.
She answered conventionally that she wished the country well, that she had never wished it ill. She signed as they told her to sign, under the title of The Widow of Capet.
On the 13th by night, 12 dragoons volunteered to take news out of Maubeuge, a sergeant leading them. They swam the Sambre and got clean away. They rode on without sleep to Givet, and there at last they heard that an army was on the march, straight for the relief and the siege. Carnot had gathered that army. There were those who had one shoe. There were those who had none. They were armed in varying fashion. They were wholly under guns. The boys straggled, marched, or drooped in. The gear of them roaring marching songs, but the greater part disconsolate. The great Carnot in Avennes that night stood like a wrestler erect and ready, his arms free, his hands unclenched, balancing to clutch the invader and to try the throw. He, with that inward vision of his, saw the whole plan of the struggle from south to north. He saw the white threads of road radiating from Paris to all the points of peril or of disaster. He saw the royal flag over Toulon and the English fleet in harbor there. He saw the resistance of Lyon.
For he had no news of its surrender.
Above all, he saw those two doors against which the invader leaned, the lines of Wiesenburg, and here, right to his hand, the entrenchments that covered the last siege of the northern frontier. He saw, reeling and nearly falling, the body of the republic that was his religion. And he saw that all the future, death or life, lay in Maubeuge. The Sunday night fell on Paris and over those long Flemish hills. The morrow was to see two things:
the trial of the Queen
and the opening of a battle which was to decide the fate of the French people.
In Paris, when it was broad day, the chief court above the prison was prepared. The five judges, Hermann the chief, piled onto the bench. A little below them, and on their right, a jury of 15 men were empaneled. There was a hatter there, a barber, and a man who had made violins, and another who painted pictures for the rich. They looked all of them towards the door that led from the cell below, where two warders came upward to it, leading between them the Queen.
She was in black. A little scarf of lace was laid with exactitude about her shoulders and her breast. And on her head she wore a great cap, which a woman who loved her, the same who had served her in her cell, put on her as she went to her passion.
So dressed, and so standing at the bar, so watched in silence by so many eyes, she heard the hard and nasal voice of Hermann. He asked her formally her name.
Marie Antoinette of Austria.
some 38 years old, widow to Louis Capet, the King of France.
The Queen sat down by leave of the court, and the trial began.
She saw,
rising upon her right, a new figure.
A figure of the terror. Fouquier Tinville.
His eyes were steadfast. The skin of his face was brown, hard, and strong. His voice was harsh and mechanical. His speech was long, dull, and violent.
The widow Capet was a Messalina, a leek, a Merovingian tyrant, a Medici. She had urged Capet to all his crimes. She had sent millions to aid her family in their war against the French people.
And when Fouquier sat down, the pile of witnesses began.
From the frontier and from the hunger of Maubeuge, no news came.
Last of these witnesses, Hébert, all neat and powdered, presented his documents and put forward his abominations.
The Queen would not reply. She half rose from her chair and cried in a high voice, "I appeal to every mother here."
Away, dining beyond the Seine, Robespierre broke a painted table in anger and thought Hébert's lunacy had saved her. The court abruptly rose. It was 3 o'clock. The first act in that long agony had lasted without food or breathing time for 7 hours.
While the Republic thus held the old world prisoner in Paris and tortured it in the person of the Queen, out on the frontier, the Republic lay in its chief peril from the old world, free and armed. Cobourg held the crest of the hills invincibly, and Maubeuge was caught fast, unreachable beyond the entrenchment of that ridge. Carnot gave order to the guns. They fired and proclaimed the presence of a relieving army to the besieged.
Just in that hour when Carnot was ordering that warning cannon, the court gathered and the prisoner was recalled. If all the witnesses which history possesses today could have been brought into that court, it would have affected the issue very little. One thing alone could affect that issue, the news of victory.
And no news came. All reports from the frontier had ceased.
The lights in the court were lit. Smoky and few. The air, already foul from the large concourse, grew heavy even for the free.
For the sickened prisoner, it became intolerable as the night hours drew in. 6 dark, interminable hours. She asked faintly for water. Boone, the officer in guard of her, brought it to her and she drank.
As she supported her, with some respect, down the silent passage to her cell, he heard her murmuring,
"I cannot see. I cannot see. I've come to the end." Just before midnight, she fell asleep. She slept deeply, and for the last time.
Tuesday, October the 15th.
A little before dawn, the French bugles upon the frontier roused the troops. And soon the army moved. Upon the left, Fromentin. Upon the far right, Duquesnoy. The main body in the center took the high road, which, if they could force its passage, would lead them straight to Maubeuge.
But guns began.
In Paris, they had wakened the Queen tardily. It was nearly 9 before the court assembled in the dull light.
There was opened before the court her little pocket, and the trinkets taken from her on the day of her imprisonment, the poor relics of her affection, the lock of hair, the miniature, were laid before the judges.
They heard the porter of the temple and sundry others. But all that business was empty, and all those hours were wasted. It was not upon such vanities that the mind of Paris was turned.
But upon the line of Flemish hills a long way off, and upon the young men climbing up against the gun.
The village of Dore was held. The French carried it. They went beyond. They were almost on the ridge above it. In the upland field below the crest of wood, the Austrian cavalry struck them in flank and they were disordered. They were back in Dore, and the fight for it was from house to house, from window to window. Twice it was cleared.
Twice lost.
The fourth attack upon Dore would have succeeded when Carnot heard that Promonta, up on the far left, had carried his point of the ridge and had the folly to pursue. Weak in cavalry, commanding men untrained to any defensive, he found opposed to him the cavalry reserve of the enemy, a vast front of horse suddenly charging.
That cavalry smashed him all to pieces.
His regulars here and there formed squares. His irregulars tried to.
They were sabered and galloped down.
They lost but four guns, but much worse. They lost their confidence altogether. They got bunched into the combes and hollows.
The plateau was cleared.
The left thus failing were not wholly destroyed, but their failure had ruined the value of the central charge upon Dore. The Austrians did not indeed pursue the retreat of the French center from its walls and lanes,
but the conception of the battle had failed.
In the courtroom in Paris, the witnesses called upon that last evening were for the most part those who had come personally into the presence or into the service of the Queen.
Meanwhile, night hastened onward, and behind thin veils of October clouds, the stars continually turned.
Upon the frontier, the damp evening and the cloudy night had succeeded one the other, and a tent pitched just behind the lines held the staff and Carnot. He did not sleep. There was brought to him a little note, galloped in from the far south. He read it and crumpled it away. It is said to have been the news that the lines of Wissembourg were forced.
And so they were.
The Prussians were free to pass those gates between the Ardennes and the Vosges. Then Maubeuge was the last hold remaining.
The very last of all.
Carnot was big with new things. He took counsel with his own great soul and called from his knowledge of the French upon the savagery and the laughter of the French service.
Those young French people, many half-mutinous, most of them ill-clothed, so many wounded, so many more palsied by the approach of death, all drenched under the October drizzle, all by this time wearied of any struggle whatsoever, were roused in that night before their sleep was deep upon them.
Carnot had determined to choose 7,000. To forbid them rest, to march them right along his positions, and add them to the 8,000 on his right extreme wing, and then at morning to charge with overwhelming and unexpected force on the right, and so turn the Austrian line.
They were 7,000. The thick night was upon them. The mist lay heavy all over the wet land.
Their agony seemed to them quite wanton and purposeless.
They were halted at last, mechanically like sheep, at various points under various sleeping farms, in various deserted, tiny, lifeless villages. They could but squat despairing, waiting for the dawn and the shambles.
Meanwhile, it was thick night.
It was nearing midnight in Paris, but none yet felt fatigue, neither the judges nor their prisoner. The last of the witnesses was done, and their tale was ended.
It was 3 o'clock in the morning before the questions were put to the jury. Questions drawn from the indictment.
Had there been relations between the executive and the foreign enemies of the state? If so, was Marie Antoinette of Austria proved to have been privy to that plan?
The jury left the hall. The prisoner was led out beyond the doors of the chamber. For one long, unexpected hour, she was so detained while the jury was still absent.
Then a signal was given to her guards, and they led her in.
She was at the end of human things. She stood and saw the judges upon the bench conferring for a moment. She stood to hear her sentence read to her. And as she heard it, she watched them in their strange new headdress, all plumes. And she fingered upon the rail before her with the gestures ladies learn in fingering the keys.
And soon the reading of the sentence was done, and they led her away.
On the terrace of his castle in Germany that night, George of Hesse saw the white lady pass, the ghost without a face, that is the warning of the Habsburgs. And the hair of his head stood up.
The long, dark hours of the morning still held the troops that had marched over from the left to the right of the French position before Maubeuge. And when the cocks had begun to crow in the steadings, all rose and stood to arms.
The queen went down the stone steps of the passage. She entered regally into the cell made ready.
But before the morning came, she laid herself upon her bed in her poor black dress. And so lying, she began very bitterly to weep.
The hours wore on. The scent of newly lighted fires came from the prison yard, and the noise of men awakening. The two candles showed paler in the wretched room.
It was dawn.
The 16th of October broke upon the Flemish hills. The men who had endured that night march along the front of the battlefield still drooped under the growing light and were invigorated by no sun.
Before them, hollow lanes led up to the summit of the little rise and the hamlet of Vatine. This most humble and least of villages was waiting its turn for glory.
In front of Vatine, holding that round of sloping fields and the low semicircular end of the ridge before the village, there were but 3,000.
The white vapor seemed lighter all around, but no voices could be heard, nor did there come up through its curtain any rumble of limber from the roads below.
As the queen so lay, disconsolate and weeping bitterly, and supporting her head upon her hand, there came in the humble girl who had served her faithfully, and who was now almost distraught for what was to come.
You have not eaten all these hours. What will you taste now it is morning?
My child, I need nothing more. All is over now.
Madame, I have kept warm some soup and vermicelli. Let me bring it you.
She must change for her last exit. So much did the revolution fear to be cheated of its defiance to the kings that the warders were bidden not to lose sight of her for one moment. But she would change. She would go in white to her end.
The girl who had served her screened her a little. And in the space between the bed and the wall, she crouched and put on fresh linen. And in place of her faded black, a loose white muslin gown.
Why must you bind my hands? The king's hands were not bound.
Yet were her hands bound, and the end of the rope left loose that her jailer might hold it. They led her out past the door of the prison. She was delivered and signed for. On the steps beyond the archway, she went up into the cart.
Up and down the passages of the prison, a little dog whom she had cherished in her loneliness ran whining and disconsolate.
The cart went lumbering on.
Her lips, for all their droop of agony, were still proud. Her vesture was new. Her delicate high shoes had been chosen with care for that journey.
The long line of troops stood erect and close upon either side. The dense crowd roared behind them.
Her face might have satisfied them all. The painted red in her cheeks was dreadful against her utter paleness. From beneath the linen of her cap, a few whitened wisps of hair hung dank upon her hollow temples.
An actor fellow pranced upon a horse, thrusting at her by way of index a sword, and shouting to the people that they held the tigress here.
Nostrian!
He went up the steps of the scaffold at liberty and stood for a bare moment, seen by the great gathering in the square, a figure against the trees of what had been her garden and the place where her child had played.
It was but a moment.
He was bound and thrown, and the steel fell.
On the low mud and slope of Vatigny, the mist began to wreathe and thin as the hours approached high noon.
With every lift of vapor, the landscape became apparent. When suddenly, as the mist finally lifted, the wide plain showed rolling southward, a vast space of wind and air.
And at the same moment, they heard first bugles, then the shouts of command, and lastly, the rising of the Marseillaise. The sleepless men had been launched at last. The hollow lanes were full of their swarming upwards. The fields were ribbed with their open lines.
And as they charged, they sang.
The few heavy guns of the Austrians were trained too late to check the onrush. The little pieces of the climbing and singing men were dragged by lanyards, unmasked behind gaps in the hurrying advance, crashed, raced, and were covered again by the living cover of the charge.
The green at the hilltop was held. The poor yards and byres of Vatigny were scoured and thundered through.
And Carnot, his hand upon his sword, and Duquesnoy, his face half blood, and all the host gloried to find before them in their halting midday sweat the level fields of the summit. The Austrian line turned, and an open way between them and Maubeuge.
In this way was accomplished what was called by Napoleon Bonaparte the chief feat of arms of the Republic.
It was somewhat past noon.
On that scaffold, before the gardens which had been the gardens of her home and in which her child had played, the executioner showed at deliberation and great length, this way and that, on every side, the queen's head to the people.
Columbia Workshop
has presented Death of a Queen from the British Broadcasting Corporation studios in London. Death of a Queen was adapted for radio and produced by Val Gielgud, head of the drama department of the British Broadcasting Corporation and one of the outstanding pioneers in the development of radio drama. The cast included Liam Quatermain, Robert Spate, Ronald Simpson, Norman Shelley, Hermione Hannan, Mary O'Farrell, Susan Taylor, J.B. Rowe, and Francis DeWolf. Tomorrow morning, the workshop director, Irving Reese, who has been here observing the methods of dramatic production at the British Broadcasting Corporation, will leave for Dublin, Ireland, where he will direct the world-famous Abbey Players in John Millington Synge's great Irish play, Riders to the Sea. At this same hour next week, the Columbia Workshop will bring you direct from Dublin, Ireland, Riders to the Sea, featuring the Abbey Players. This is Ed Morrow speaking and returning you now to America.
This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.